Michael Rourke had pictured it as something like the Soviet underground city had appeared, but it was not. The Soviet underground city had been, when seen from a distance like this, merely a utilitarian tunnel, much like the railroad tunnels he remembered seeing as a boy, and some of which still survived after a fashion today. He saw the Chinese city first as they reached the summit of an almost unnaturally circular range of moderately high, jagged peaks. Beneath them, in the valley, was where it lay, rising out of the ground like some sort of magnificently geometric flower, segmented, each segment vastly large, a half dozen segments already visible, others, he imagined perhaps a dozen in all, partially uncovered. The city had been buried, he realized. Built, buried within the valley under what would have been millions of tons of dirt and rock, and was now, perhaps over the space of decades, being uncovered.
It's beautiful.
Michael rested his hands over the steering wheel and stared. The fully uncovered segments were a dark cream color, like the petals of a rose. Beside two of the fully uncovered segments were pagoda-shaped structures, some apparently completed, others seemingly under construction. The once buried segments of the city were forming the basis for a new city that was emerging before his eyes. Heavy equipment moved dirt and rock, and what appeared from the distance to be thousands of men and women moved about the structures, working to complete them.
I thought you had no fuel.
Our heavy construction equipment is electrically powered and must be recharged every several hours. We have electricity in abundance. Originally, our reactors were fission-powered, but in the third century of our confinement beneath the ground, fusion was at last conquered, and we have clean, safe power to supply all our needs.
How did your people get outside, if the city was buried, as it appears?
There are entrances throughout the mountains here. Many of them since resealed, American. Many of them were large enough and designed to accommodate the transfer of construction vehicles like those of which you see now. It was all planned by our leaders 5 centuries ago, and thank God it was successful.
Yes, for all of us.
Michael started the vehicle down along what appeared to be a service road leading to a paved highway, perhaps a quarter mile further down along the gently sloping side of the valley. The road was only 1 lane wide, but there was sufficient room on both sides of it to be broadened should it become necessary to do so. His father would like these people. They planned ahead. Behind him, as he drove, Maria Leuden knelt in the vehicle's bed, Otto Hammerschmidt's head in her lap, Rolvag and his dog with them there as well. Hammerschmidt sedated against the pain of his burns. Some of the German spray which promoted healing had been used on his burns, but Hammerschmidt was feverish, the sedation necessary against what Michael judged must have been excruciating pain. Michael could see railroad tracks now, and steam-operated locomotives coupled to massive flat cars, and, leading from some of the flat cars, ramps. Michael assumed the Chinese had a source of coal to run the steam locomotives. They reached the single-lane highway, and Michael turned onto it toward the city, the road looping the valley several times before reaching the level of the city, but the drive easier and faster for Hammerschmidt than going cross-country. It was gradually warmer as the vehicle descended. Michael throwing back the hood of his parka and freeing one hand from the steering wheel to open his coat.
Why did your people pick this area, Han, for the construction of their city?
The rail lines which once served Harbin were easily extended to service the construction site in those days, and it was felt, even if the more disastrous possibilities became reality following a nuclear war, the railroad beds would still exist, and perhaps the rail lines themselves. As it happened, the beds indeed existed, but were buried beneath generations of ice and snow, and it required many years of work with explosives to make new beds beyond our valley. We were able to construct rail lines leading to the sea and hope to construct ships, but this will not be in my lifetime. At least, I presume not. Do your people have sea power?
No, we don't. We could, I suppose, but there hasn't been time. Why do you ask?
There have been incursions coming from the direction of the sea. Attacks on a distant outpost we have established by the Yellow Sea. It was thought wise for us to have a military presence on the seacoast. We have a small town as well, but for the most part, the wives and families of military officers and the men who work on the new fusion generator systems live there. And this is where, someday, we will build our ships.
Where do you mine your coal?
For the locomotives we run, you mean. They are steam engines, but require no coal. The water is heated by fusion generators, American. We may have no synthetic fuel, but we are not entirely without resources.
Why is it that you utilize arms from 5 centuries ago, and in such a poor condition?
Isolated as we were, there was no need for mass production of arms, although we had the capability. When we re-emerged, it was practical to arm our military forces with the weapons from before the Dragon Wind. But as we realized we had a fierce and implacable enemy in the second city, it became necessary to revise these plans. And the production of arms was begun. We have a well-equipped army, but to equip our Mongol mercenaries with the newer weapons would betray them as being in our employ. So the old weapons are still issued.
Michael started into the final straightaway, which would feed into the city itself.
The first petal there. Turn in the access route.
The first petal?
Does it not remind you of our flower, our city?
Michael only nodded, slowing, taking the turn. He expected security at any moment to come crashing abruptly down on them, but none had yet, and none seemed forthcoming.
How do you guard this place?
You will soon see.
Michael didn't like the tone of the remark and slowed the vehicle.
You should stop this conveyance here, American. Go no further.
Michael realized in the next second that Han did not comprehend how brakes worked, the front end of the vehicle slamming into something that seemed impossibly non-resilient. Michael shuddered as the vehicle lurched backward, taking his hands involuntarily from the wheel, the conveyance, as Han again had called it, dead.
What the hell?
You did not stop rapidly enough, American.
Do you know the expression, shove it up your ass?
What is happening?
Armed men appeared from inside the tunnel, which seemed to lead inside the petal. The assault rifles they carried decidedly different in profile from the 5 centuries-old weapons he had seen earlier. Han stepped out of the vehicle and waved his hands in some sort of signal. One of the armed men signaled to the others to stop their advance. Han went to speak with the man in charge. Michael's hands were on the butts of his berettas beneath his coat. He didn't draw them. Michael climbed out of the vehicle.
The curtain will be shut off momentarily. I told the officer that you are official ambassadors of the United States.
Everyone pulled guard duty from time to time, and Akiro Kurinami, not liking it, didn't resent it. He imagined it was simply his turn to be unlucky. The guard posts were divided equally among the Germans who supported their otherwise untenable position at Eden Base and the Eden personnel, every other post German, every other post Eden. Because of the international composition of the Eden Astronaut Corps, few called themselves Americans. Kurinami, huddled in his parka, gripped the M16 that was slung to his body merely by the pistol grip, his gloved trigger finger alongside the trigger guard. He expected no trouble. The German surveillance devices would have detected it. He had drawn perhaps the most remote of the guard posts, and with the heavy snow that had begun a few hours before, visibility was less than 100 yards. But it was, in one respect, a good time for security. Every guard would be awake and moving, patrolling his post, since it was the only way to keep from freezing. The abrupt change from cold to below freezing with snow had been unexpected. But he supposed that with the radical change in the Earth's environment, the unexpected was to be expected. Had it been less nearer to dawn, he doubted he would have been able to see his hand in front of his face. His thoughts focused on Elaine Halverson, soon to be Elaine Kurinami. Thinking of her somehow kept him warmer. Someday, he knew, they would both look back on this as they told their children of the early days of the return to Earth, of having to stand guard in the middle of what could soon turn from a heavy snowfall into hard blizzard conditions, and the children would stare at them, agape at such an existence. He thought he saw something moving as a gust of wind cut through him like a knife and temporarily cleared the air of snow.
Halt! Who is it?
Kurinami licked his lips beneath the toque which covered his face except for the eyes. His right first finger slipped into the trigger guard, his right thumb finding the safety tumbler and moving it into the full auto position.
Who is it? Who is it?
Kurinami saw a shape, not definable enough to be certain what it was, and he wheeled toward it, bringing the muzzle of his rifle up. Kurinami spun around, seeing another kick coming in. He grabbed the foot with his left hand and twisted it hard. He saw someone in a hooded parka and ski toque and white snow smock tumble into the snow near him. Kurinami was up, moving, his right arm still all but paralyzed. Another figure lurched at him from the snow. Kurenami reached to his hip for the government Model 45 there, but his right hand still wouldn't respond. The first man was coming for him, and Kurenami tried another kick. Kurenami felt a sudden dullness, and then a warmth that he knew was somehow unnatural, and the whiteness of the snow which swirled around him was turning to blackness.
Elaine.
Maria Lloyden resisted it, but then, as she dressed before the mirror, she tried to search out for Michael Rourke's thoughts. She was obsessed with knowing if he loved her, she realized. Ever since he had taken her up into his arms and carried her as if she were just some tiny child. The clothes given her were beautiful to wear, but she didn't care about them. She closed her eyes, thinking of Michael Rourke. She had not seen him since they had passed through the tunnel. Some of the soldiers carrying the stretcher they had placed Otto Hammerschmidt upon. An electrically powered vehicle of some sort, which was like an ambulance, arrived, and Otto Hammerschmidt disappeared inside it. She had been given over to a woman named Toy, and facilities for bathing, for washing her hair, fresh clothes, all had been made available to her. She assumed Toy was some sort of intelligence agent, much like Han. Maria sat on the edge of the rather ornately styled bed. Her glasses had been placed on the small table next to the bed, Maria still utterly surprised that they had survived through her ordeal. She looked at herself in the mirror. A tall, skinny girl, in love with a man whose mind she could read. But only when she was with him, really. She feared that she would, as time went by, be able to read his thoughts even when they were separated by some distance, as she had been able to with her father and her friend Elsie, who had died. And what she feared most was that if Michael refused to care for her, that she would be able to feel his thoughts forever, even when he was with another woman. And that would drive her mad. The SM-4 had been completely disabled, and they had left it at the energy field barrier leading into the tunnel, Michael having taken up his pack and the spare assault rifle, an M-16, then proceeding through the tunnel and into the city in the company of Han and some 18 soldiers and an officer. The tunnel had been far less than remarkable, except for the smoothness of the joints where it was sectioned. But once through the tunnel, he had been even more impressed than he had been at his first somewhat distant view of the first city. The tunnel had been steeply downsloping, and Michael had assumed that he would enter the city at its lowest level. But instead, they had emerged before a roadway, and beyond the roadway were towering buildings rising to a height he had judged as several hundred feet, the tunnel mouth at the level of their pinnacles. There was something like a train station near the tunnel mouth. He had remembered when a boy, his mother taking them to Atlanta, and parking the car in a large parking lot, and then boarding a train at a station like this. She had called it a subway, but this train was a monorail. And as it crossed from the tunnel mouth over much of the petal, as Han had called this wing of the first city, Michael was amazed. He had considered it a symbol of friendship that he had not been asked to turn over his weapons, and perhaps also a symbol of Han's eminence in the city. For that reason, he had elected, after showering and changing to fresh clothes from his pack, to leave the assault rifle and the 629 in his room, wearing only the double shoulder rig with the Beretta, but beneath his leather jacket so they would not be seen. Han had been waiting for him when he emerged from the suite of rooms he had been given, the rooms in a large building that seemed at once to house offices, yet be some sort of official residence. Han had changed as well, his skin several shades lighter than it had appeared, his stubble shaven away, and only the thin mustache remaining. His clothes consisting of a gray suit with a collarless jacket and conventional shoes rather than boots. He looked anything but the Mongol warrior he had appeared to be when they had first met a day before.
You appear renewed, American.
Michael rubbed his face with his left hand.
I suppose I'm renewed, if you could be renewed when you're too tired to sleep.
Tired or curious, American?
Both.
Then come and meet our chairman. You are awaited. Your pistols under your coat will be acceptable as long as they are not drawn.
None of the new German J-7Vs had been available to speed their flight to Iceland, but one had been available on the coast of Norway, and Rourke, Natalia, and Rubinstein had transferred from the German helicopter to the versatile aircraft with its dynamically rear-swept wings and rear-mounted jet-driven propellers, which allowed it to change from horizontal to vertical flight mode almost at will, as fast as a conventional jet, but with the maneuverability of a helicopter gunship. John Rourke had resisted the temptation to ask to be allowed in the cockpit, and when the invitation to do so had come, he had refused it as well, forcing himself to sleep, knowing that he would need it. As the J-7V changed flight modes for landing, he awakened. Paul asleep in the seat opposite him, Natalia beside him.
We are just going into landing mode. While you were asleep, I went forward. They let me try the controls for a few minutes. These machines fly beautifully. I have to check out on one. It might be a useful skill.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
If Vladimir has finally changed directions, perhaps we can somehow more effectively anticipate him.
Gotta find out how Michael's doing, too.
Yes. I think our Fräulein doctor likes him quite a bit.
Maria Luden.
Yes. It would be good for him. Michael is too young to be alone.
Chronologically, he's older than you are.
I think he'll always be little Michael to me. But he wasn't little, really. Was he even big as a baby?
Oh, 9 pounds and 4 ounces and not an ounce of flab. Yeah, he was a big baby. Then he hit a growth spurt and it seemed never to stop.
What are you and Sarah hoping to have? Or don't you care whether it's a boy or a girl?
So long as it's healthy, we'll be happy. Look, I'm sorry I messed you up. I didn't mean to do that to you.
You don't mean you and Sarah having the baby, then...
No, I don't mean that. I mean, well, falling in love with you. You loving me. I left you holding the shit end of the stick, and I'm sorry. If I could... But I really don't know what.
I'll always love you, and I realized a long time ago I could never have you. I won't lie and say I'm all perfectly adjusted, John, but I'll survive. Maybe you did that for me.
Captain Hartman seemed weary, Rourke thought.
There have been many developments, Doctor. The gunship which carried your son and Fräulein Dr. Luton under the command of Captain Hammerschmidt has been out of radio contact for some 24 hours. We have no idea why. At the last report, your son had determined that the search might best progress on foot, and they left with one of the SM-4s, the Icelandic policeman Bjorn Rolvag accompanying them. The last communication from the SM-4 vehicle was prior to young Herr Rourke, Fräulein Dr. Leuten, and Captain Hammerschmidt climbing a high escarpment toward what appeared to be a fire of other than natural origins.
Damn. Not a word since?
Not a word since, Doctor.
What about the direction Karamazov's forces are moving in?
That is rather disconcerting. It roughly approximates the direction from which your son's last radio transmission originated.
At its present rate of movement, how rapidly would Karamazov be able to reach that general area?
Approximately 72 hours was a to stop for, 2 rest periods of 6 hours each in that time.
With no rest periods, they would reach that general area in 2.5 days. That is very little time.
That's time enough. We'll take that J-7V if you don't have any objections.
I will dispatch Lieutenant Schmidt to assist you.
No. We'll need a pilot, co-pilot, and a small security team to secure the immediate area where we touch down. And those special items I asked for, have they arrived?
Yes, but they have not been field tested, Doctor.
We'll field test them in the field. Get them loaded aboard. Paul, see to it that we've got all the ammo and spare magazines we can carry. Replenish anything that's running low. Natalia, marshal together extra clothing, rations, medical supplies. All right, let's be airborne in a half hour. They were already refueling the J-7V when we left the field. That's enough time for you, Captain Hartman?
Yes, Doctor.
What are the chances of getting reinforcements from the complex in Argentina to assist us against Karamazov?
Not very good, I'm afraid. But I shall endeavor to get what reinforcements I can. It appears we will be fighting soon.
We'll see. I want to let him get to where he's going and then stop him. That's the riskiest way of doing it, but it's the only way. If he has another supply of that gas or something worse.
I will make certain, Herr Doctor, that an adequate supply of masks are available to you. It is my intent to keep moving our main body up behind Marshal Karamazov's forces while still maintaining a defensive posture in the event he turns his army and attacks. I have units monitoring the Soviet forces constantly, so we should have adequate warning.
Let's make a prearranged transmission schedule. Every 6 hours once we're on the ground. Then, if you do not hear from us...
We're up Schitt's Creek.
Kiro Kuranami writhed, trying to escape the electrical shocks.
Lieutenant Kuranami, where are the duplicate files?
It was the same question they had begun asking him hours ago. Or was it longer than that? He could no longer be certain. The files contained the locations of the supply caches where weapons, food, building equipment, and medical supplies had been buried 5 centuries before for use after their return. The original files had been wiped from the Eden Fleet onboard computers, and Kuranami's copy was the only one which existed, except for the copy whoever had cleared the files had taken. If he surrendered them, whoever possessed the files would control Eden Base unless the Germans stopped them.
Kill me. You won't get the files. If I die, you will never get them.
We will take Elaine Halverson. Perhaps she will answer us.
No!
Then tell.
No!
The voice stopped.
I'll kill you, Yohama. I will kill you. I will kill you if you...
Michael sat in a straight-backed chair in the middle of a high-ceilinged room at what he estimated to be the exact center of the building. Another straight-backed upholstered chair, empty, was a few feet from his, facing him. Han stood beside him.
You straighten out this ambassador stuff?
I said that it was meant figuratively rather than literally. Do not worry, American.
The room was utilitarian in its furnishing, seeming to be made of something like marble. Michael reflected that perhaps it was marble. Han had said nothing which intimated anything about the person whose room this was, whose empty chair now faced Michael Rourke. The walk to this room where Michael now sat had been long but pleasant, Han explaining that indeed this building was the seat of government of the first city, as well as the residence of the chairman. The additional apartments, like those occupied now by Michael and Maria Leuden and Rolvag and his dog, were just 3 of more than 24 kept on hand for government officials to use in times of emergency, when their special abilities might be required by the chairman at any hour of the day or night. When they had left the building, briefly, to journey, this time by public monorail, to the hospital where Otto Hammerschmidt was being treated, Michael had again marveled at this city within the earth. At first glance, past the beauty of its architecture, it might well have seemed forbiddingly uniform, as if all of its inhabitants were like ants in a tunnel. But there was individualism, subtle yet definite, everywhere he looked. No 2 gardens alike, no 2 buildings identical. And in the hospital, in the monorail station, on the public monorail car itself, the faces of the people bespoke happiness without anything vacuous, a dignity of personal identity. The Chinese, he felt, based on his readings, had indeed come far. The doors at the far end of the room opened. Through the doors walked a man. He was tall as Michael or his father easily, and thin, without at the distance appearing painfully so. His hair was steel-gray rather than white, and full but cut short, seeming to crown a craggy face which looked at once Asian yet Western as he approached. His body was covered in a black ankle-length tunic that rustled slightly as he drew near. Michael wondered if it were made of silk, something for which the Chinese had always been famous in his day and before. The man, his eyes rock steady, hands folded in front of him, stopped some 6 feet behind the vacant chair. Michael stood.
I am Lin Xiaotang, Mr. Rourke. How do you do?
An honor to meet you, Mr. Chairman.
The honor is mine. Please, be seated. I have recently left a rather pressing meeting and find it more comfortable to stand after so much time seated. You and your friends were the subject of the meeting. But rest assured, the meeting was a pleasant one. You are indeed an American?
Yes, sir.
An informal ambassador, I am told. Meaning, I take it that you and your friends were exploring this portion of Asia, and since you have discovered us, shall we say, you would represent your people to us. But let me assure you, we were not lost.
I hadn't thought that you were, sir. But you presume correctly. We were exploring, and it was then when we encountered Mr. Han and learned for the first time that your people had survived what we call the Great Conflagration, and you call the Dragon Wind.
Both rather picturesque terms, Mr. Rourke. You were just exploring?
As you no doubt know, sir. We, meaning the few surviving Americans, the people of New Germany, in what before the Dragon Wind was called Argentina, and the people of Lidveldid Island, have formed an alliance against the Soviet Union forces under the command of Marshal Vladimir Karamazov, who, like myself and my family, is a survivor from the period before the night of the war.
Lin Xiaotang reached out both his hands as he stepped forward, appearing to steady himself against the back of his chair.
I have misunderstood.
I fear you have not misunderstood, sir. Through a process known as cryogenic sleep, myself, my family, and some others, both from among our enemies in the Soviet Union and from among the persons living now in the United States, survived. I was born in the last quarter of the 20th century, and it is now the 25th in our reckoning.
If you do not wish to sit down, I at least do.
Michael sat down opposite him, feeling it rude to remain standing.
And you fight a war with the Russians?
There was an attempt at a coup in the Russian camp, an attack by the army of Marshal Karamazov against his government leadership at their underground city in the Ural Mountains. A less elaborate structure, to be sure, I understand. The position of the actual Soviet leadership within the city is unknown, but a state of war exists between ourselves and the forces of Marshal Karamazov. He took his vast army to the east, and I and my companions traveled ahead of his advance to determine his possible destination. I believe we have found it, sir.
Indeed.
The J-7V landed, John Rourke and the two men from the four-man security unit being the first to disembark the aircraft. The helicopter was some 50 yards away, and no sign of anyone around it. The jeep-like vehicle with which Michael, Maria Leuden, Hammerschmidt, and Bjorn Rolvag had set out. Rourke looked behind him once, Natalia and Paul Rubinstein disembarking, clad in their Arctic gear. Two more of the German security team with them.
Paul, have those two men stay with the plane.
Right.
Rourke took the senior of the two Germans with him by the arm.
Fan out to both sides of the helicopter. Keep 50 yards back from it. Find some cover in case it's wired to detonate or something. Move out.
The two complied with Rourke's orders.
Natalia, take my left. Paul, on the right.
The helicopter was moored against the high winds, but already its runners were partially drifted over with snow, the windshield partially covered as well. Snow drifted beneath the craft and all but obscured the chin bubble. It seemed clear the helicopter hadn't been moved in at least 24 hours.
I should go in first. I'm better with explosives.
We'll both go in. Paul, keep an eye out on the outside.
Be careful, guys.
As he glanced toward Natalia, she was slinging her rifle across her back diagonally, muzzle down, and unlimbering the German explosives detector. They were within 15 yards of the helicopter now. Rourke opened the front of his snow smock and his parka so he could have more rapid access to his handguns. He started ahead again, seeing Paul Rubinstein out of the far right edge of his peripheral vision running toward the chopper at an oblique angle, covering the hatchway with an M16. Rourke stopped beneath the main rotor blades and peered inside. He saw no sign of life, but the glass itself was steamed and frozen over, and to see with any clarity was impossible without opening the sliding door.
Are you ready, John?
Yeah. Just don't touch anything yet. Let's get up closer.
Rourke started to close the distance between himself and the machine, Natalia sweeping the German explosive sniffer ahead of them over the snow and ice.
It's clear.
Rourke pushed her back, safing the M16, then taking the butt of it and rapping it hard against the door. Nothing happened. He let Natalia work the door handle as he worked the safety back into the auto position. The frozen body of a dead man lay in the widest beam section of the fuselage. But the dead man wasn't Michael. It was one of the German air crew, and from the rank, he assumed it had been the gunner.
Throat slit, it looks like.
Yeah.
Nothing's been touched, and it doesn't... There's no sign of the pilot or anyone else.
No. Run the sniffer.
All clear.
Natalia made her way into the chopper. Rourke followed after her, his eyes narrowing as he scanned the interior more closely. There appeared to be no damage to the instruments, almost as if whoever had killed the gunner had wished to keep the helicopter in good condition.
Did you sweep the corporal's body?
Yes, and he doesn't look rigged, but don't turn him over. I want to check first.
All right.
Rourke dropped to his knees beside the dead man. With the conditions of extreme cold, even a detailed autopsy might not accurately fix time of death. There was a bruise on the man's lower left cheek, which appeared to have been incurred just prior to death. With his gloved right hand, he felt the back of the man's neck, just above the hairline. The German military wore their hair short, and he could see most of the bruise easily enough.
I think he was hit with a rifle butt or something like it. On the face, then on the neck.
His throat was slit after he died.
Yeah, that's the way the wound to the throat looks. And the lack of bleeding seems to go along with that.
He was stone dead, and someone either slit his throat because they were too dumb to know for sure, just out of the desire to do it.
Who, John? An advance party from Vladimir's force?
I don't think so. For one thing, they would have stolen the helicopter or destroyed it.
Whoever it is, I don't think we'll find the pilot's body outside.
Neither do I. He's probably a prisoner.
Vladimir Karamazov had ordered the meeting for the short interval while the central element of his force stopped for refueling, the lead element moving ahead. The rear element paused as well. He remembered the Americanism leapfrogging as the most apt description for what he was doing. This central element would become the lead element for the next leg of the journey. Before him, in the open, a cold wind cutting across his exposed skin with the sharpness of a razor, stood Colonel Ivan Krakowski, a man he did not trust except for ruthlessness, which nearly rivaled his own. With Krakowski stood 50 members of the new elite corps, Krakowski at their head.
You may stand at ease. I have something to tell you. Doubtlessly, you have heard by now rumors that we got to obtain the nuclear stockpile of the People's Republic of China. I will tell you things which you need to know before setting out on your mission. Before the night of war, the Chinese emulated the preparedness of the Soviet people and constructed two cities. A third, under construction but never completed, lost to time. The Chinese had a formidable nuclear arsenal, not nearly so formidable as that of the people of the Soviet, or our enemies in the United States, but substantial. The Chinese realized that sheer force of numbers of their people could not win in a war against the superior technology and the superior will of the Soviet war machine. And so it was decided that these cities would be built. And 10% of their nuclear arsenal was taken offline and placed deep in an impenetrable storage vault. In the event that the two cities, which they had designed to survive, should find their very existence threatened.
The Chinese premier had barely touched his food. It seemed as though something were on his mind. Seated with him were Michael Rourke, Maria Leuthen, and Bjorn Rolvag.
Our leaders planned with great wisdom. They realized that in a post-Holocaust environment, loyalties could well be sacrificed in the lust for power, for domination of the ruins, as it were. And so, the secret to the location of the vault in which 33 state-of-the-art nuclear weapons were cached was broken into three parts. The leadership of each of the three cities entrusted two of the parts. Thus, in the event that one of the cities was destroyed and the location of the nuclear warheads was needed, two of the cities would have the ability to jointly find the cache.
Was it considered that in such a manner it would be possible for two of the cities to join in league against the third?
But if each city had possessed only one portion of the secret, then the destruction of one city would have resulted in the secret being forever lost. There is an expression in English, I believe, the lesser of two evils? The Maoist reactionary government of the second city clearly wishes to possess our two portions of the secret. And with these and their two portions, have all three.
2 + 2 = 3.
Quiet, young man. Indeed, 2 and 2 do = 3 in this context. And with this sum, the leader of the second city would spread his barbarism over the face of the earth. If the world beyond our city is as you tell us, Michael Rourke, the three segments of the secret could well be the goal sought after by your vile-sounding Marshal Karamazov. The great majority of the thermonuclear devices held by the People's Republic of China were never used and are hidden in their silos and storage bunkers beneath the ground and might well be usable to someone ingenious enough to find them. With the 33 warheads dangling over the collective heads of the peoples of Earth, at his leisure, an unscrupulous man might be able to locate the remaining more than 250 warheads. Indeed, it is said by some that in the cache of the 33 weapons, there is a map by which could be found the remaining weapons.
A sword of Damocles.
This was the first time Maria had spoken since they had seated themselves around the black lacquered table and begun their meal.
World War IV. World War last.
Ivan Krakowski watched the hero marshal, hatless, his black hair moving in the wind, his figure straight and tall and imposing, his dark eyes burning with the fire that inspired those about him.
And so, under the leadership of our trusted comrade Colonel Krakowski, utilizing the information I alone possess from before the night of war, you 50 will go forth to the secret hardened site where 10% of the Chinese warheads can be found. You will inspect the warheads, ascertaining that they can safely be moved, and then rendezvous with our force at the predetermined coordinates Comrade Colonel Krakowski will possess. Go forth in the name of the Soviet people to the greater glory of scientific socialism, to fulfill our historic destiny. I will speak with Comrade Colonel Krakowski alone.
As the hero marshal retired, he stopped and turned to Captain Krakowski.
You will prepare for the mission.
Already, in his mind, Krakowski was composing how he would record this moment for posterity. For surely this was the greatest of all moments in the history of the Soviet people, and it had been entrusted to him. And he wondered why, because clearly the hero marshal seemed jealous of his abilities. The hero marshal stopped beside his command helicopter. Krakowski followed suit. No pilot sat at the controls. The hero marshal seated himself in the co-pilot's chair, but it seemed odd because Krakowski had never seen the hero marshal fly.
Krakowski, I am entrusting you with something of vast importance, as I am sure you understand. Sit down.
Krakowski took the pilot's seat, studying the hero marshal's face.
You will be tempted, Krakowski, to keep the power of these weapons for yourself, as well as any man might be. But you do not know the secrets which I know, which will enable their use, if need be, make them the palpable threat to humanity which I intend they be. If you do my bidding and remain loyal to me, you will eventually know these secrets and share with me power. Power greater than even you can imagine there could be. I had foreseen much of what might transpire. My great enemy, John Rourke, it is said, has an expression he uses often. Plan ahead. I foresaw and planned that one day I would triumph. That day is nearly at hand. The setback at the gates to the underground city was a costly one, one for which I can again give credit to John Rourke. The gas, which we still possess, will enable us to easily overwhelm small forces or fortified positions. But the power contained in the vault of the Chinese traitors is an irresistible power, which can sweep continents to our will. If you keep faith with me, you shall triumph with me. If you betray me, you will never know a night's sleep again. Or someday, I will vindicate myself, even though it might cost me my own life. Do you understand me, comrade?
Yes, comrade.
The hero marshal entrusted him with the map coordinates which would lead him to the 33 nuclear warheads. The cyclones of snow intensified, and the black of the hero marshal's eyes deepened. Akira Kurinami lurched forward and his face impacted heavily against the hard surface, but his hands were in front of him. He lay there for an instant, then moved his hands to his face and pulled away the blindfold. He squinted against a light which was not there, in total darkness except for the glow of the electrically powered heating unit at the far corner of the enclosure. But he was certain it was a room. His teeth found the knots of the ropes which bound his wrists, and he began to gnaw at them. Elaine. He had to save her. To free himself before the return of the men who had taken him prisoner and who, even now, would be bringing her here. Paul Rubinstein had found them. He hadn't believed his eyes. Now, John Rourke and Natalia Tyamarovna stood flanking him, staring at the ground.
These animals are small. Asian horses. They're shod. One of them was carrying double or an extraordinarily heavy rider. But I prefer the latter.
They had found the remains of a fire nearly a quarter mile from the abandoned helicopter, John Rourke having deduced that the captors of the pilot had spent the night there after seizing him. Paul had agreed with John's logic. Had the men who had taken the pilot stayed there before attacking the helicopter, their fire would have been clearly visible and given the pilot and co-pilot either time to lift off or in some other way ward off the attack, the gunship heavily armed. At the least, time for a distress signal. John Rourke rose to his full height, taking the German radio from beneath his parka.
This is Rourke. Rourke to Courier. Come in. Over.
This is Courier. Receiving you. Over.
Courier, I want those three crates opened and have the security team start preparing the contents. Rourke out.
In a strange way, Paul Rubinstein had found himself looking forward to this. Michael had eaten the dinner, not enjoying it, although the quality of the food was impeccable. The conversation had turned his appetite. The chairman had been required at another meeting, had left the dinner table with profuse apologies, and requested their presence for a late-night drink in his private apartment. He had looked even more tired when he rejoined them. The room in which they sat, a library, was modestly furnished, almost Spartan, except for the books it contained. The languages were in most cases recognizable to Maria Leuden or to Michael himself, and Rolvag had smiled when he had spied several books in the Icelandic tongue. There was a smallish, low table around which they clustered. The chairman had spoken of many things, most trivial, but at last, making a tent of his fingers and placing the tips of his index fingers to his eyelids, he addressed a question which Michael had been searching to introduce throughout the evening, but had not.
It was called Lushun before the dragon wind obliterated it from the face of the earth. Of all nations, China's loss was perhaps the greatest. Our population all but totally destroyed. When we determined some years ago that it would be to our interests to have available ships with which to cross the seas, Lushun was determined as the place to undertake this endeavor. We have small ships there even now, but no true ocean-going vessels as once crossed the waters. To facilitate this program, we constructed a rail line to reach Lushun, completed several years ago. But a short time after we established a presence at Lushun, the attacks began. Men came out of the sea, heavily armed, but in small numbers, placing explosives, killing. It was debated whom these men might be, perhaps Americans, perhaps others. None has ever been captured, and those few killed in battle with us have never been identified, except as Westerners. It was debated as well that we might best serve our goals by abandoning our port. I personally spoke against this, although I have no love for warfare. The reactor was nearly completed by the time the next series of attacks came, and it soon became the target for these mysterious interlopers. Perhaps they will someday attack in force, or perhaps they cannot.
You say they came from the sea, in ships, I presume?
No. They literally come from the waves.
In scuba gear?
Self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. The acronym, yes.
When was the latest attack?
Michael looked at Maria and smiled.
5 days ago. Some among us thought that you might be part of these attackers. I argued against that.
If Karamazov had sea power, I think we would know about it. Are there markings on the scuba gear taken from the dead?
There are none. Nor on the weapons, which are very sophisticated, I am told. So you see, we fight a small but bloody war with an unknown enemy and a continuing battle of harassment with the Second City. We need no more war, but I fear it has been thrust upon us. Tell your people, these men of Iceland, these new Germans of Argentina, and the people of your Eden Project.
Michael had explained the Eden Project and the use of cryogenics, including his survival and that of his family. The chairman had seemed amazed, but accepting.
Tell them that they have an ally in the People's Republic of China, here in the first city. This indeed was the topic of the meeting for which I left so hurriedly. I shall dispatch Han to accompany you.
Han had not joined them in the chairman's apartment.
We came by helicopter. You are familiar with these devices, I am sure.
The term is not unknown to me, though I have never seen an aircraft of any type. I suppose our engineers have the abilities to construct such machines, but we have consumed our talents with other, more pressing concerns.
Our helicopter dropped out of radio contact about the time Dr. Luden and Captain Hammerschmidt were taken prisoner. It is possible your enemies from the Second City are responsible. I would like to request that you dispatch a modest number of troops with us when we attempt to return to the helicopter. And I would further like to request that Captain Hammerschmidt be allowed to remain here until he is fully well.
But of course. Then you will carry our embassy of goodwill to your allies?
I will be honored, sir.
Akira Kuranami had found the second knot to be more difficult than the first, and he felt certain that he had loosened at least two of his teeth. But he told himself that they would tighten. Kuranami got awkwardly to his feet, using the wall for support. He touched the surface of the wall and realized he had been taken to the construction area, and he knew the construction area well. He walked along the wall and found the airlock hatchway. He summoned his strength and found the wheel-like handle and began to turn it. The door had not been sabotaged, the wheel turning freely, and as he wrenched against it, the door opened and he half fell over the flange. There was a stronger gray light here, and he started along the access tunnel, the light intensifying as he neared the exit to the outdoors. Kuranami was very near the mouth of the tunnel now, the temperature colder here. Freezing already in his sweat and waste-stained coveralls, he had no idea what had become of his Arctic gear. He had known better than to even consider the fate of his M16 and Colt Government Model 45. Near the entranceway, snow falling heavily outside, swirling in what seemed like a strong wind, the howl of it filling the tunnel mouth, he found what he had sought. And now, if the battery for the bulldozer was not too cold... The motorcycles had been designed for uneven terrain, drifted snow, for traction on ice. John Rourke had taken the best features of 20th century motorcycles, with which he had been familiar, and conferred with German engineers, the same team which had designed their mini tank, and they had produced something beyond which he had thought possible. Four of them, to be precise, he thought. Three of them here now, the fourth in Argentina being tested for improvement before actual production. The German engineering team had asked him what he wished to have the motorcycle called. He had deferred to them to decide, as the persons who had taken ideas and hastily sketched drawings and hastily listed specifications and turned all these into reality. They had simply called the motorcycles specials. John Rourke was the last to mount, Natalia and Paul already having climbed aboard.
And remember, on level terrain when it's dry, these things will do 160 or better, which is a lot more speed than you'll ever really need.
You know, if I find any dry level terrain, I'll remember that.
Word from Captain Hartman was that heavy snow was falling, slowing the advance of Karamazov's army, which was good, and that six gunships, obviously heavy laden, had lifted off into the worsening blizzard conditions and headed toward Manchuria. Rourke mounted his machine. It was the same general size as his Harley, but in his heart it would never take its place. It was built to run on synth fuel and was more fuel efficient than conventional machines which had been built to run on gasoline. The fairing was contoured to body shape, protecting the lower body, armored as was the high-rising windshield, the windshield fitted with defogger coils, the fairing on each side fitted with 12-inch barreled hybrid machine guns. The tires, the entire bodywork of the machine, was armored against conventional small arms ammunition. The suspension was self-adjusting for highway or flatlands use, or for steep or rugged terrain. It was as close to the perfect means of overland transportation as possible, able to go places where no vehicle could go, in theory, and outrun most conventional vehicles as well. Rourke almost whispered into the microphone built into the helmet's rigid chin guard.
All right, everybody hear me?
Gotcha.
Affirmative.
All right. Remember, these things are fast and it's slippery. Be cool.
Be cool. With the wind chill, the temperature must be 40 below.
Instruments aboard the J-7V indicate a wind chill closer to minus 50. Let's go.
Rourke let out the throttle, starting away from the German aircraft, the security team and the pilot and co-pilot staring after them as Rourke looked back once. The machines were vastly different than the Harleys stored at the retreat, but the feeling was the same. At his right, Natalia. At his left, Paul Rubinstein. The two best friends he had ever had. Akira Kuranami huddled beneath the dashboard of the bulldozer, and he saw them. And his heart sank. Three men carrying M16 rifles. And between two of the men, he saw a body being carried by wrists and ankles as though dead. The body was that of Elaine Halverson. The third man walked at the head of the file. His rifle, held in his right hand by the carrying handle, like someone might carry an attaché case, and just as casually. They would have to pass within 10 feet of the bulldozer. Less than a dozen yards to go now, one hand on the starter, the other on the control, which would drop the shovel. He realized his hands trembled. Less than a half dozen yards, his grip tightening on the release lever for the shovel. He inhaled, waiting, released part of the air. The lead man just beneath the shovel, almost past it. Akira Kurinami's hand worked the shovel release. Kurinami dove over the shovel, toward the forwardmost of the two men who carried Elaine. Kurinami realized he had only split seconds before the last man opened fire. He took the man's head in his hands. Akira was on his knees. The last man was struggling to get his rifle forward on its sling. Kurinami summoned all the strength inside him. Kurinami's head impacted the last man at the abdomen, his hands going for the knees, behind the knees, ripping. As the third man came to his knees, his assault rifle coming up, Kurinami, on his right side, snapped his left foot up and out into the throat. Kurinami crawled to reach Elaine. He pulled her hood back. She was breathing, shallowly but evenly. He curled back her left eyelid, the eyes glassy-looking, the pupils dilated.
Drugged.
He fell back on his haunches. Beside him was the second dead man. He pushed back the hood of the snow smock and the parka. The face belonged to a man he had never seen before. Not Eden Project. Not one of the Germans.
Who?
The wind had erased the hoof prints in all but those areas which were sheltered from its force by natural windbreaks, rock overhangs, narrow gaps. The last set of prints seemed deep and fresh. The darkness and the swirling snow had made finding them consume nearly 2 hours.
They must be stopping for the night soon. If they build fires, typically like the remains of the one we saw near the helicopter, we'll spot them. Unless we stumble right on them, let's stick to the plan.
Michael had been told there was a snowstorm outside, but inside the petal of the first city, all was serene and the artificial light was unchanged. After the drink with the chairman and his ambassadorial charge, he had taken Maria into the corridor where her apartments could be found and then left quickly, going to see to Hammerschmidt's condition. Michael Rourke had found his way to the monorail and to the right stop for the hospital without incident. He had been told that Hammerschmidt was progressing extraordinarily well, and though no miraculous overnight healing could be expected, Hammerschmidt rested comfortably and the burns seemed less severe than originally thought. Contented, Michael had returned to his apartment, showered, attempted to leaf through a book. It was a 19th century English novel, and though Michael had read other works by the same author, it did not capture his interest. Sleep was what he needed, but it wasn't in him. He thought of Maria Leuden. She would probably be asleep by now. In less than 12 hours, they would be leaving to link up with the helicopter and find out why it had gone out of radio contact. He looked at the two Beretta 92Fs in the double shoulder rig hanging on the headboard post. He could always clean them again, but the interval since the last cleaning had been so short that powder residue could not have sweated out of the bore, and the cleaning would be essentially useless. He was naked, except for a pair of underpants, and he walked back toward the bed, skinned into his blue jeans and the shirt he had just worn, and ripped both Berettas from their leather, stuffing them beneath his shirt, butts outward against his kidneys. Michael Rourke started from the bedroom. He walked down the corridor. Michael stopped at the door, so much like his own. Maria Leuden wore a blue silk-looking robe tied about her waist, her glasses on, her eyes huge seeming behind them, her left hand pushing her hair back from her face.
Michael, I...
He stepped inside the doorway, his hands touching at her waist, then his arms encircling her.
I love you.
Michael Rourke brought his mouth down on hers, molding her body against his. When they reached the top of the rise, it was at first hard to tell how far away the fire really was because of its size. But after some observation, Rourke decided the captors of the pilot were a little over a mile distant. He pulled the helmet from his head, taking the radio from beneath his parka.
Rourke to Courier. Come in. Over.
This is Courier, Doctor. Come in. Over.
I'm leaving this frequency open. Are you ready to fly? Over.
Ready, Doctor. My co-pilot stands by. Over.
I estimate your ETA in 16 minutes from liftoff. Rourke out.
He pocketed the radio, leaving the frequency open to serve as a homing beacon. He replaced his helmet, his ears numb with the cold from the brief exposure.
With them out in the open like that, we won't be able to accurately judge their strength until we're right up on them. There shouldn't be more than 8 or 9 at any event. We need the pilot alive, that's why we're here. And we need one of whoever they are alive to find out who they are. Like we planned it, up the middle. Natalia gets the pilot, right?
Like we planned it.
Yes.
Nice and slow until we're close. Once the superchargers on these bikes kick in, they'll hear it. Now we sit here for 12 minutes.
John Rourke had judged the time needed to cross slowly to within 200 yards of the camp and then accelerate into the camp as about 3 minutes. If these people had not stolen the helicopter or damaged it, there was substantial reason to believe they were not familiar with aircraft to any substantial degree, if at all. The fact that they rode horses, the inefficient but deadly means with which they had dispatched the gunner, all pointed to a certain primitiveness. Rourke checked the face of his Rolex. It was nearly time.
All right, let's start out nice and slowly.
Rourke let the machine rumble forward, Natalia moving into the center position. Rourke to her left, Paul to her right. Rourke checked the gauges on the special's instrument panel. He ruled out using the explosive charges, which could be expelled from the bike, and with the rising force of the wind and the snow it drove, smoke would have been of little effect. They had crossed half the expanse separating them from the campfire, Rourke increasing speed slightly, Natalia and Paul following his lead. He armed the twin machine guns. He consulted his wristwatch. The helicopter would be due, barring the unforeseen, in 1 minute. The J-7V timing itself to sweep in from the opposite end of the plateau 60 seconds after the helicopter. He swung the M-16 slightly forward, charging the chamber, leaving the safety set to safe.
Now!
Men were rising from around the fire, great mounds of snow falling from the lean-to shelters in which they had protected themselves. Rourke seeing the outline of rifles coming up. Rourke and Paul opened up with their machine guns. Natalia accelerated past them, dead for the center of the camp. Rourke twisted the fork, cutting into the camp to the left of the fire, not using machine guns, instead stabbing the M16 forward. As Rourke wheeled the special, he saw Natalia in the center of the camp, a man swinging a burning club toward her, snatched from the fire. She dodged, the special she had been dismounting collapsing against her. Rourke throttled out, aiming himself and the machine toward the center of the camp, the motorcycle lurching beneath him. Rourke let go, diving from the motorcycle and tackling the man with the burning club as he swung it down toward Natalia. Rourke was up to his feet, wrestling the special free of Natalia.
You all right?
Yes.
The helicopter roared in overhead. A man dove from the shadows beyond the fire, a long-bladed curving sword in his right hand. Natalia was beside him then, both her revolvers in her fists as she approached a formless thing on the ground. Rourke let the M16 fall to his side, opening his parka, ripping the twin stainless detonics pistols from the leather.
John, he's alive. It's the pilot.
The J-7B streaked overhead, dipping its wings, the slipstream around it tearing at Rourke's face and hair as he pulled the helmet from his head. And he dropped to his knees beside one of the dead men. For all the world, the man looked like a Mongolian warrior.
Jesus, right place, wrong time.
I got one!
Rourke looked around and saw Paul Rubinstein dragging a man through the snow by his heels. Natalia spoke to the Mongol, having tried several different dialects of Chinese, none of which she considered herself to speak well, until at last there had been some flicker of recognition in the man's eyes. He seemed terrified. Terrified not at anything a rational man would have feared, but at being taken inside the German helicopter gunship.
Now that he knows this thing flies, he is afraid of it, more so than any of the guns he has seen or any of us.
Ask him if he knows what happened to Michael.
Kwangi tik nuao gik narn? He says, I think, that he knows nothing about anything.
Paul stepped forward, taking the black cat's paw handled Gerber MK2 from his belt, almost shoving her aside, grabbing the Mongol by the front of the man's tunic like shirt, the knife in Paul's right hand going to the Mongol's throat.
Then Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, and Mary had a little lamb. And what about Mother Goose?
You almost started me laughing, Paul. That could have been terrible. You could have at least said something threatening to him.
Paul, with overly dramatic reluctance, stepped back, feeling the blade of his knife and smiling wickedly. John making a show of holding him back. The man could barely contain himself after that. He'd told her that he was a soldier of the Second City. He told her he knew nothing about the tall man's son, or a woman with green eyes, or a man with blonde hair, or a huge red-haired man with a dog that looked like a wolf, or a cart on wheels that needed no horses to pull it.
Where is the Second City? He says the evil man with the knife can kill him, but he will never tell.
Paul started into his evil man with the knife act again.
Nice job, Paul, but no.
John turned instead to the pilot of the helicopter, the co-pilot of the J-7V.
Take her up. Just straight up into the air and hover.
Yes, Doctor.
Natalia could feel it in her stomach as the aircraft began to rise, the look of terror in the man's eyes rising with the regularity of an altimeter. Rourke threw open the door to the fuselage.
All right, you Mongolian fuck! Start talking or it's time to fly, motherfucker!
Rourke pointed first to the Mongol and then to the open door. The man seemed to get the message. The Mongol dropped to his knees, one of the German security team starting to grab for him, but Natalia waved him back. The Mongol touched his forehead to her feet. Ivan Krakowski had taken personal charge of navigation for the fleet of six helicopter gunships, trusting no one with the coordinates given him by the hero marshal. For a short while, the fleet of gunships had passed out of the teeth of the blizzard, but now the snow swirled around them maddeningly, crusting over the bubble, Krakowski taking the controls of the gunship for a time to relieve the pilot of the strain. The windshield wipers raced crazily, but could not compete with the rate of snowfall and wind-driven snow as it lashed against the machine, the five other machines barely visible even by their running lights. The hero marshal had told him that the cache of some 30 Chinese weapons was near the city once called Lushun, in what had once been a mine, the interior of the main shaft reinforced with concrete and steel and capped like something the hero marshal had called a well. It was cold, and colder still from the feeling of fear which he unashamedly admitted consumed him. The machine which he flew was buffeted by winds of what he estimated to be gale force, and the controls had to be manipulated with the greatest precision, not just to keep on course, but to keep from being thrown into an uncontrolled spin and the machine destroyed.
All co-pilots are to relieve their pilots of flight control for a period of at least 30 minutes. Pilots, get some rest.
Krakowski would find the coordinates, but if the storm intensified, he doubted he would be able to take off. And the hero marshal and the destiny of the Soviet people depended on him. Michael Rourke studied Maria Lloyden's face in the gray light of the room in which they lay, and his thoughts were consumed with his dead wife. It was not rationalization. She had cherished life and would wish him to do the same. Had he celebrated life by invading Maria Lloyden's loins, or had he merely satisfied lust? He was drawn to her, and for the first time since Madison's death, there had been a moment when he had felt real happiness. Maria Lloyden had cried as she held him, Michael for the first time appreciating the sadness which had consumed her as well, resulting from the rape she had endured years before and the scorn of her lover because somehow he had blamed her for it, or for not having the grace to die during the process.
This is the first time I have ever been loved willingly by a man.
Oh. It was more than unnerving to consider loving a woman who could read your thoughts. If Annie could actually read what Paul thought, she never alluded to the fact. But with Maria, he had known from the first moment aboard the aircraft taking them to Egypt that she could see inside him. He wondered if it had brought him closer to her or kept him away. Madison's body had been more beautiful, and he doubted he would ever see a woman who could compare to her in her beauty or her compassion. But he realized he loved this woman now as well. He pushed away the sheet and started to rise. There was something he had to do. Michael left the bed and put on his pants and shirt, taking his two pistols as well. He left her apartment and walked as quietly as he could down the corridor. Rolvag and his dog were nowhere in evidence, and Michael assumed that at last the giant man in green had retired. Michael let himself into his rooms and stripped away his clothes, showering quickly, his body still remembering Maria Lloyden's touch. He toweled his hair as dry as he could make it, then dressed in fresh Levi's and a fresh shirt and his Arctic gear, except for the parka, which would be too warm to wear until he left the petal. He had a pass from Han, which would allow him to come and go at the main entrance. He took only the Beretta pistols and slung the shoulder rig in place. With the parka over his arm, he left.